he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of the Cape Elizabeth Church of the Nazarene in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Download more sermons or learn about the Cape Elizabeth Church of the Nazarene at our website, capenazarene.org. Here's Pastor John Twitchell as he delivers this week's message.
I am curious this morning, how many of you have read this book, Who Moved My Cheese? A couple of the business people in the room have done so. So if the book has bad connotations for you, then I apologize early on this morning. I know how some of those business books can be. You kind of hear them over and over and over again, and you're just sick of them. But there's only two or three of you who have read it, so that's good. I'm going to save the rest of you from having to go out and buy it, because I'm just going to give you kind of the synopsis of it in the next couple minutes. It's written by Dr. Spencer Johnson in 1998. It's kind of this modern-day business parable that was designed to help people deal with change in life. Now, it's been a while since I read it, so I'm bound to have some of the details wrong. Nancy and Stuart, you can clear me up on that later on your way out. But the basic premise is this, that there are two mice and two little people who are living in a maze. You know what I mean, one of those mazes that the behavioral scientists use to figure out what people will do or what animals will do as they test their new theories out. And in this particular parable, cheese is put into one of the feeding stations, and the mice and the little people learn that they can go every day and find the cheese at this feeding station, and there'll be plenty of cheese to eat. All of this is good until one day, sniff, one of the little mice, he begins to sniff out that change is on the horizon. He becomes aware that the cheese supply is beginning to diminish. And so he talks to his friend Scurry, and Scurry, his friend, the other mouse, is prepared to go scurry into action to find where there might be some new cheese that could be found. And so Sniff and Scurry are prepared to deal with the change. But the little people, Hem and Haw, that's their names, Hem and Haw, they have a little bit more difficulty when the cheese moves. Hem and Haw, they start to blame each other. They question who it was who moved the cheese. They get angry. They wait. They hope that the cheese will return and come back. Haw finally suggests that maybe they should go look for more cheese, like their friends Sniff and Scurry. But Hem is so paralyzed by fear of the unknown and his own preconceived expectation that they'll never find any more cheese than what's right here, and so he doesn't want to go anywhere looking for more cheese. He just expects the cheese will come back. So Haw decides to strike out on his own. He eventually discovers a new cheese station, and when he gets there, he discovers new varieties of cheese that he's never tasted before, and it's wonderful, and there's more, and he comes back, and he tries to tell Hem about this and to get Hem to come. But unfortunately, despite several of those attempts to convince him otherwise, Hem never ventures into the rest of the maze. He prefers to stay instead at the old familiar food station with no cheese, hoping that life will return to what it once was. So you sort of understand the parable. The cheese can kind of represent anything in life, really. It's certainly food, but it could represent your job or a goal or family stability or relationship. It could represent some facet or quality of your church, even, that just kind of that's the cheese, or something that you're attached to, or something that provides you with meaning and purpose, or even something that gives you comfort and peace. That's the cheese in this particular parable. But we all know this, that the only thing in life more certain than death and taxes is change. It doesn't matter how comfortable your life is. It doesn't matter how successful you are, how important you are. Your wealth, your status, or success are not enough to protect you against the powers of change. Hear this. Even our faith in God will not ensure that life remains stable and unchanging. Right? We sang about an unchanging God a bit ago. Great is thy faithfulness, unchanging and holy, and who was and is to come. But even our faith in an unchanging God does not mean that somehow life will stay stable and unchanging. While God will never change, we can bank on this, that at some point or another, most everything in our life will change around us. While God is our solid rock, we can be certain that the rest of our lives are really just shifting sands, at best able to give us the illusion of stability. The question is, how will I face the inevitable change in my life? The question is, how will I respond when the change comes my way? What will you do when the cheese is moved? Will you be paralyzed by fear and indecision? Will you blame the unseen hand that has been previously and graciously providing the cheese for you? Or will you live in denial, sort of expecting the cheese to return if you just wait long enough? Will you express anger at your friends and cut yourself off from the support system around you? Or will you sniff out the coming change and strike out on a new adventure with God, believing that God will provide for you, and perhaps, just perhaps, there might even be something better in store for you? Well, we want to talk about Elijah the Tishbite this morning. Elijah has a great deal of work ahead of him in life, and if you read about Elijah this week, you know there's that contest on Mount Carmel with the 850 prophets of Baal and Asherah, and then after that contest, we discover him running for his life for 40 days and 40 nights, and then finally encountering God's still small voice on the mountain. There's a lot of Elijah stories we could tell, but before we get to all of that, there's the beginning of Elijah's story. The part we already heard this morning in the first six verses of 1 Kings 17. So Elijah has gone to King Ahab. King Ahab being on record as probably the worst of the kings. And Elijah goes to King Ahab and tells him that because of the sin, there will be a severe drought in the land. And Elijah has been given the task to confront the king with the truth, to speak truth to power and to confront him. You can imagine, if you were Elijah, you could imagine kind of gearing up for that confrontation, and then when it's over, just kind of needing a big break, a big rest, a big breather. So God arranges a sabbatical for the man of God. He sends him out to this brook and tells him to go camp out next to the brook. And while it probably didn't happen quite like this, I kind of like to imagine the hammock strung between two trees and Elijah laying there swinging in the hammock, reading a book on his Kindle, and there's a campfire over there with fish frying on the campfire, and that's kind of life for Elijah. This is nice. This is pleasant. And to top it all off, Elijah doesn't even have to go fishing or hunting for his food. He doesn't have to make anything because the ravens are coming twice a day, bringing him bread and meat. And while you might wonder about the sanitary conditions of bread and meat brought to you by ravens, for Elijah, this was pretty good. This was pretty great stuff going on. I wonder, if I were Elijah, and of course we know the rest of Elijah's story, but Elijah doesn't. I wonder, did Elijah think, you know what, I did my deed. I was faithful, I accomplished the thing, God is rewarding me, and I just get to hang out and retire here brookside for the rest of my life. And this is pretty nice. But then we read the very next verse in the story, 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 7. Why don't you read it with me? Sometime later, the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. Sometime later, the brook dried up. I want to just stop for a moment this morning on that part of that sentence. Sometime later, the brook dried up. What do you suppose went through Elijah's mind when the brook dried up? If I had been Elijah, I'm just honest this morning, if I had been Elijah, I think I might have gotten a little bit angry here when the brook dried up. After all, Elijah had been faithful. He did what God had commanded him to do. He had confronted the king. Surely the very same God who could send ravens with bread and meat twice a day, surely that same God could figure out some way to keep the brook flowing. Right? Even in the midst of a drought, surely that God could have figured out a way for there to be water for Elijah to add on to the meat and the bread that came twice a day. Elijah could have shut God out. Could have lived in denial. He could have just kind of waited there under that tree, a little shade there, just hoping the water would start to flow again. He could have insisted that he deserved the brook, that he had worked hard for this reward. He could have given up on God altogether and simply gone back to doing whatever it was he did in Tishbe before God had called him. He could have been paralyzed by fear, unwilling to move from the site that he knew so well, afraid the situation could only get worse from here, out of the frying pan into the fire, so to speak. Elijah could have chosen to die of hunger and thirst right there by the brook. just expecting that the water would come back. Or Elijah could have tried to do things on his own, kind of struck out on a hike looking for an oasis somewhere else in the wilderness or another brook that maybe still had some water left. He could have gone hunting for water and hoped to kill some wildlife near that water so he could feed his hungry stomach. But what we find is that none of those things are part of God's plan for Elijah. And if we keep reading, we discover that what God had in store for Elijah was ultimately even better than the brook and the ravens and his hammock. Let's keep reading in verse 8. Hear the word of the Lord. Then the word of the Lord came to him. Go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I have commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food. So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink? As she was going to get it, he called, and bring me, please, a piece of bread? As surely as the Lord your God lives, she replied, I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son that we may eat it and die. Elijah said to her, don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said, but first, make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me. And then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain on the land. She went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. If you were to keep reading through the rest of the chapter, you actually discover that not only did this new scenario provide Elijah with food, and not only did it help then provide a blessing for this dying widow and her son by providing them with food and keeping them alive, but we discover that this arrangement also resulted in an amazing miracle. Because we find that that son died, and because Elijah was there and God was using them, that son was able to be raised back to life after he died from an illness. Consider for a moment, if Elijah had done any of those other things that we listed off, had he gotten angry, lived in denial, cut himself off from God, struck out and tried to do it on his own, had he done any of those things, Elijah would have missed out on the blessing that God had in store for him, and Elijah would have missed out on being the blessing that God had in mind for Elijah to bless this widow and her son. What do you do when the brook dries up? What do you do when someone moves your cheese? I don't know what your brook is. I don't know what your cheese is. It could be anything. Success at work, a healthy family, a particular ministry or calling of God, or even a sense of rest and renewal, perhaps like it was for Elijah. When we're at the brook, everything seems to be going well. There's plenty of food. The children are making good decisions. The church is growing. There's success at work, and you'd like to believe that nothing will ever change. If you could picture kind of a perfect life, that's what you find at the brook. But as I said earlier, the only thing more certain in life than death and taxes is change. Ultimately, we can know for certain the cheese will move, the brook will dry up, and the question that we become left with is, how do I respond to the change in the world around me? We could choose to live in denial and accept to keep our lives as similar as possible. We could try to pretend that nothing had happened, nothing had changed. You've seen folks in denial who refuse to ask for any help because they don't believe they need the help. They assume that if they wait long enough, things will eventually fix themselves and go back to the way that they were. Or we could choose to get angry, to find someone to place the blame on. You've seen folks do that, to cut themselves off. Instead of trying to make good and healthy decisions, to try to figure out what went wrong and who's responsible. And whenever we do this, we take our anger out ultimately, usually on the people we love. And we end up pushing the very people we need further away from us. Or perhaps you've been here and you've been so paralyzed by the fear of the unknown that you settle into inaction and do nothing. This person is unwilling to try the new thing that God has in store because They're afraid of failure. They can't possibly imagine the new thing could be better than the old thing. And they keep trying to go back to the way things were instead of exploring the new reality that they're discovering. Well, we could simply give up. We could convince ourselves we'd somehow earned the brook, that we'd worked hard for the brook, that we somehow deserved the blessings, and give up trying anything in life until we get our way again. I want to be careful that you don't hear me trivialize change by talking about cheese and brooks. You understand what I'm saying? The fear of a parable is that somehow we trivialize all of the very complex things in our life. And sometimes life deals us horrible and unthinkable situations. And our best attempts to do the right thing are frustrated, and we're stuck living with the results of decisions other people made. Or we're stuck living with the results of the systemic evil in our world. Sometimes we inherit problems that were not any of our creation, due to powers completely outside of our control. And while we're tempted to blame God for them, we know somewhere deep in our heart of hearts that they're ultimately a result of brokenness and sin, and that God can redeem even that. So without trivializing some of those just monumental things that life deals our way, the question still remains, how do I respond when that happens? When life deals us this curveball, we have to deal with the pitch that we've been given, not the pitch we wish we got. How is that for a baseball analogy? Or if some of you would prefer, I might get in trouble with some of the Nazarenes in the group, when we're dealt a hand of cards, we have to play the hand of cards we were dealt, not the one we wish the dealer gave us, right? When the brook dries up, we have to be willing to go follow God's leadership, even in the new and the unknown. So I'm reminded of another story. I love this story. If you've heard it, I apologize, but I don't think I've ever told it here. The story about the colonial British gentleman in India. They wanted to play golf. Thought golf would be a great thing to do while they were colonializing India and doing all of that. So the British gentleman got up and, you know, set up golf courses. But they became increasingly frustrated with the monkeys. Anyone heard this one before? As far as I know, this is a true story. The monkeys would run out onto the fairway and grab the golf balls. They loved to play with them. They thought they were neat. They thought they were fun. They would grab them. They would play with them. They would run around. Finally, they'd get bored and they'd drop the golf ball somewhere. And as you can imagine, the British gentlemen would try to do whatever they could to deal with the chaos created by the monkeys. The golfers in the room can just only imagine the horror, right? They tried to scare them off. They put up fences. They posted sentries to try to run them off. But even then, they had a decision to make. What do they do with the golf ball? Do they give the golfer a do-over? Do they try to figure out where the ball was supposed to have landed? Do they try to figure out where the ball was before the monkey grabbed it? Or do they do complex math and physics and try to figure out where it should have gone? Or do they just give up the game altogether and forget trying to play golf in India? Ultimately, the golfers decided on a particular set of ground rules for this course. And the ground rules were summarized like this. You play the ball where the monkey drops it. You play the ball where the monkey drops it. Whether it was in the sand trap or in the rough, or maybe it was just a couple inches from the pin, that would be great, right? You play the ball where the monkey drops it. In other words, we don't get a do-over in life, do we? You don't get to put that ball back where it was. You wish you could, but you don't get to. You don't get to attempt to do fancy trigonometry and physics to figure out where it would have been or what could have happened or what should have happened. All we get to do in life is play the ball where the monkey drops it. So many forces that are outside of our control, we know that sometimes the cheese moves. Sometimes the brook dries up. There's nothing we could have done to stop it. And friends, brothers and sisters, it may very well not have been caused by God at all, but part of the systemic evil and decisions that other people made. But it's still the hand of cards that you've been dealt. We could try to figure out who to blame. Attempt to get it back to how it was or how it was supposed to turn out, but the reality is that none of those scenarios are helpful at all because none of them can we ultimately do. We have to play the ball where the monkey drops it. And ultimately, this is what our friend Elijah does. He doesn't get mad. He doesn't live in denial. He doesn't do any of those things. He hears the voice of God to say, go. And trusting the voice of God, he strikes out to do this new thing into the unknown. He's never been that way before. But as difficult as it must have been to ask a dying widow for her last scraps of food, Elijah humbles himself and asks for help. And as long as the widow makes Elijah the food first, there's always enough for herself and her son. The miracle of the widow's oil reminds us that God is always enough for all we need. Max Lucado puts it this way: if God is enough, you'll always have enough. You see, the problem arises when we think we need more than God. When we think we deserve something in life, the brook or the cheese or the golf ball, if you will, a comfortable retirement or good health or success at work, when we think that we deserve these things or they're somehow essential to our needs, then the change is likely to cause us even greater heartache. When the cheese moves, we mistakenly believe we needed that cheese. When the brook dries up, we don't know how we'll possibly live without the brook. When the golf ball moves, we demand that it gets put back right where it was. But if God is enough, if God is enough, then you'll always have enough. When we truly believe that God is all we need, when we content ourselves with God and God alone, then we can be absolutely confident that God will always be enough. We've been reading through these Old Testament guys. I almost said heroes, and some of them aren't heroes so much. Cain's sacrifices of fruits and vegetables who were not acceptable. Saul, who didn't get to keep the throne that he had received, or David, who didn't get to build the temple that he wanted to build. We'll get to Jonah, who didn't get to see Nineveh destroyed the way he wished for. These are guys who didn't get their way. They didn't get the thing that they thought should have happened. And whether or not Elijah really wanted to stay by that brook or not, I don't know. If I'd been Elijah, I would have wanted to stay right by the brook. And I know I wouldn't have gotten my way in this particular story. The problem with those guys I just listed wasn't that they didn't get their way. The problem was how they reacted when they didn't get their way. So Cain doesn't get his way about the sacrifices, and in a murderous rage, he kills his brother Abel. Saul hunts down David, goes all over the kingdom trying to hunt down David because he doesn't get his way, and Jonah was so angry with God that he said he'd rather just die. But the other two guys I listed, David, doesn't get to build the temple, but he graciously accepts that God has something better in store for him than that. And Elijah graciously accepts that God has a new way for him to see God's hand at work. And ultimately, these guys believe that God will be with them, and perhaps, just maybe, God has something even better in store for them. So I leave you with this. What do you do when your cheese moves? What do you do when the brook dries up? Let me suggest this, that like Elijah, we listen for the voice of God. And we try, as difficult as it may be, to look for the new thing that he's trying to accomplish in our life and in our situations. And even when the situation seems horribly broken and unredeemable, to do our best and to look for God to bring about his redemption. And in the midst of all that, to trust that God is absolutely enough, enough for every thirst, enough for every need, and that only God can satisfy. Amen.
The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with your spirit. Amen. We hope this sermon has encouraged you with the gospel of Jesus. If you have any questions or would like to learn more about how Jesus can make a difference in your life, please email Pastor John at pastorjohn@capenazarene.org. May God richly bless you as you serve him today.